starting a private practice isn't what it used to be. Today's clinicians are starting private practices much quicker, easier, and cheaper than before. And they aren't guessing their way through it or getting stuck in analysis paralysis. They're following a tried and true roadmap in order to save time, money, and frustration. There is no reason to reinvent the wheel or struggle to figure out how to start a private practice on your own. We've helped thousands of SLPs and OTs through this process, and now we want to help you too. For a limited time, I'm offering a free copy of our private practice roadmap, specifically for SLPs and OTs who are curious about private practice and want to see what the journey looks like. To download your free copy, please visit startyourprivatepractice.com/roadmap to sign up. Now, on to the episode. Alex Green is a speech-language pathologist with a private practice called Green Family Therapies in La Verne, California. She grew up watching her mom work as a school-based SLP and fell in love with the field, but decided to start her private practice after being in an unsupportive work environment. In this episode, Alex talks about how she almost left the field entirely right after her clinical fellowship when she felt exploited, overworked, and unsupported. We also talk about how having a clinical director has helped her maintain work-life balance as a neurodivergent SLP. If you're a neurodivergent SLP or OT who's thinking about starting your own private practice, Alex is a great role model, and you are going to love this episode, so stay tuned. I'm Jenna Castro-Casbon, CEO of The Independent Clinician and founder of Private Practice School. First, I started my own private practice, and then over the past 15 years, I've worked with over 10,000 SLPs and OTs to start and grow their successful private practices so they can have more freedom, flexibility, fulfillment, and finances. I created the Private Practice Success Stories podcast to share what's possible for you, your family, your clients, and your community when you choose private practice. We'll share everything from small private practice side hustles to flexible lifestyle private practices to traditional brick and mortar practices and everything in between. You'll meet regular clinicians just like you who followed our steps and are now living their private practice dreams. If they can do it, you can do it too. So let's get started. So welcome, Alex.
Hi, thank you, Jenna.
To start out, can you please share your name, your location, and the name of your private practice?
Yes. So my name is Alexandria. I am a private practice owner in Southern California in the city of La Verne, and my practice is called Green Family Therapy.
So I'm so excited to have you on the show and to have you share your story. And what I would love to do is, can we please go back to the beginning of, maybe not your life per se, but the beginning of your career at least, and talk a little bit about, like, when did you start thinking about private practice?
So I'm a second generation SLP. So my mom was an SLP as well. And I grew up going to work with her during the summers and watching her just work with kids and light them up and just have fun at work. And so I knew I wanted to be an SLP because of my mother. And so I went to graduate school, did the whole process we all know what that's like. I actually decided to start my private practice while I was still in my CF because I just couldn't take the working environment. I didn't enjoy working. I had two CF placements. I didn't enjoy either of them. I felt a bit exploited, overworked, and unheard, and entirely unsupported in both of these placements. And I honestly thought, Jenna, I thought I was going to leave the field entirely after my CF.
Breaks my heart. And I hear that so many times, especially for people who like are very capable, have hearts of gold, like love the profession, and yet for whatever reason are questioning whether or not they've made the right decision.
Yeah. At that point, I'm 10 months out of graduate school and just having paid $70,000 for that experience. And I was already thinking of quitting. That was very alarming to me because I didn't want to quit, right? Second generation, my mom did this. It's in me. I can do this. And then getting through graduate school with my daughter, I was a single mom. I had a five-year-old when I went into graduate school. Having succeeded and really pushed through so much to get to that point, it was really alarming to me that I felt like I couldn't participate or stay in this field. So I thought to myself, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I decided after my CF, I was going to go into the schools while I was working on building my private practice. And I started with a couple of the clients that I had taken from my CF experience. And I started seeing them privately. And within a year, I went into my private practice full time.
I love that. I don't love that you had that struggle in your CF, obviously.
Yeah.
But I love where it got you.
Yeah.
And then it got you just kind of from the very early part of it saying, you know what, this like traditional working environment is not for me. Now, can I ask you a question about your mom? What settings did your mom work in?
Yeah. So my mom was an elementary school SLP.
All right. So she wasn't a private, she didn't have a private practice.
No.
So she did also. No.
Okay. No, she didn't have a private practice. In fact, like when I was opening my private practice, she's like, I don't know why you just don't go work in the schools. And I've been like, I don't want to be there. But thank you, Mom.
Yeah. So you were forging your own path anyway, right? Like the career path, you were kind of following in your mom's footsteps.
Yes.
But the actual path to private practice, as it were, was something that you navigated yourself. So tell our listeners, like, how did you do that? How did you get that first client?
Yeah. So I struggled a lot. I struggled, Jenna, because there was no one like you 8 years ago. 9 years ago, 10 years ago, showing us how to do this. And I wasn't diagnosed with ADHD at the time. So I wasn't even aware that a lot of the struggles I was experiencing were due to my ADHD. And speaking of ADHD, what was your question? I'm sorry.
That's a good question. So I have ADHD too, and I don't remember what my question was. Oh, about how you got your first client and like, what did the clients look like?
Okay. So I got my first client, my first two clients. As I was leaving my CF placement, these two clients insisted on coming with me. And there was no contract that I signed that said I couldn't take those clients with me. So they came with me. And so that's why I got the first two. And I saw them, I think I was seeing them in home, individual home health sessions. And I saw one of the little girls for like a year. And then the other family I saw for maybe like 8 months. And then one was early intervention. And then the other one was a teenage girl, I think she had cerebral palsy. So it was pretty expansive. So those are like my first two clients. And then I started working on a contract for early intervention through the state. And then that's when I was able to transition to full time, is when I got that contract.
Awesome. Is that like, because you're in California, right? Is this like through the regional center?
Yeah, through the regional center. Yeah.
Great. I always hear about this amazing opportunity to get EI clients through the regional center. California is a state that does it. There's a couple other states, but that's like such a fantastic way build that early caseload.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. It was. And that is exactly where my heart was in my practice. My heart was with early communicators. That's what I wanted to build my practice on. That was the specialty of my practice. It continues to be the specialty of my practice. We still have several regional center contracts. We work primarily with the early intervention kiddos, and we're helping families and parents learn how to communicate with their emerging communicators. It's beautiful work. It's amazing work.
And you get to do it on your own terms. So can you share a little bit about what that part was like? Right now, you started your clients on the side, and then I think you said within a year, you had built up your full-time caseload.
Yep.
What kind of basically accommodations did you make for yourself as the boss to make your private practice work for you?
Yeah, like zero, like none. There were none. And this is why I say, Jenna, I really needed you, okay? Because when I first got that, when that contract came through, Jenna, I started scheduling all these evaluations. I think that first month, I may have done something like, I feel like it was like 20 to 25 initial evaluations for kids. And so many of the kids needed 2 hours a week of therapy. So based off of the initial evaluations, I was recommending 1 hour to 2 hours of therapy for 20 kids. I had a caseload like this. So January, I was doing all the evals. Come February, boom, had a full caseload. And I was driving like 2 hours away from my house some days to do therapy with kids in their houses. I was all over the place. And I did that for maybe 6 months. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to lose it. Like, why did I start private practice in the first place? Just to do this to myself. And then so that's when I hired my first slippa. And then shortly after that, I was like a mad woman. I was hiring everybody.
Nice.
And within a year of hiring my first employee, I had a team of 10 to 12 home health therapists. Yeah.
That is fantastic.
It was
listeners/viewers. Well, I know it was a lot, but still that's very impressive, right? It's very impressive to go from nothing to a full caseload for yourself and then to a full team in that rate of time. Pat yourself on the back. That's huge.
But there was like no work-life harmony there whatsoever. Yes. But when you're first starting out a business, it really is just like, it's a lot of grind, right?
Totally. Yeah. And it's completely normal in the beginning of your business to wear all of the hats, right? Mm-hmm. And to drive to any place at any time and to pick up clients that aren't really ideal for you, right? That you're competent to treat, but they're not really like your favorite kinds of clients.
Absolutely.
I actually recommend that people do that when they're first getting started, just to build your confidence, to build your caseload and, and get some income coming in, right?
Absolutely.
But then start to back off and have some boundaries and that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Especially when you're in the building phase. You're really just getting your name out there, right? You're building your toolkit as well, right? I was so fresh. Like, I started private practice so fresh out of my CF. And like, I did a year in the schools and then I was like, boom, private practice, like full throttle. So I'm glad that I had the experience working with a variety of different types of children and different types of homes. And I look back on that time like thinking, wow, you were really on one, Alex. You were very busy and stressed all the time, but it's really valuable. It was a really valuable experience. And I do actually still look back on it fondly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we all start somewhere.
That's right.
And you can either dip your toe into the private practice water or you can kind of dive right in, which is what you did.
And cannonball.
Well, listen, a cannonball is better than a belly flop.
That's right. I love it.
But look where you are now. So when was that? Give everyone like a little context about like the year. Like, when was that? And then right now we're in 2024.
Yeah. So my contract with Regional Center came through in 2016.
Okay.
Yeah. At the end of 2016. So it was like December 2016. And then so again, by February 2017, I had full caseload. And then I had a full team of in-home therapists. We were all the way out in the desert, or I should say I was out in the desert, all the way down to Temecula. It was really expansive. So that was like the first 3 years of the business. And then COVID happened. And that was a really hard time for my business. Really hard time. It's the first time anything like that had ever happened. And all of these state agencies who have hundreds of in-home vendors are now like, what are we going to do with all these in-home services? And so what ended up happening is that there was like a brief pause, a brief scramble. What are we going to do? Okay, stop in-home services. And there was like a brief moment there. And it was like, whoa, things like really kind of, it was just a really hard time, I guess. It was like really just in your face or in my face. Then Regional Center decided, or the state decided, hey, teletherapy is a viable option. And so almost like overnight, one of my therapists, Vivian, she was an SLPA that worked with me and then became our clinical director at our main clinic. Almost overnight, she transitioned us into virtual therapists. And she was like, okay, guys, this is how we're doing this. And thank God for her, because I was so scared and anxious and worried about payroll and our clinical space. And what am I going to do with all these kids and these families? And all of the private kids, they're the first ones to drop. But our regional center and our state-funded contract grew exponentially actually during that time. But at the beginning, it was very scary. And the few months, I would say all of 2020 was very scary. Everything felt very up in the air. And I ended up having to let go like a big swath of my team. And it really did feel like just completely starting all over again.
And I mean, that was a terrifying time for private practice owners, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, were just, everything grinded to a halt in terms of payments, mm-hmm. in terms of everything. And so I remember that being a terrifying time.
Yeah.
And the people who figured out a solution quickly were mm-hmm. able to more or less navigate through it. Like, yes, with some scars, with some losses, with some hard times, but with so many lessons learned. But I just remember people in my programs, the ones who figured out how to, and I hate this word now, but pivot, right? The people who figured out how to pivot were able to like really make the most of it. And then the other ones who just kind of stayed stuck, frankly, never really recovered in the same way, right? So kudos to you. And let's talk about your person who was your clinic director, right? Like, I think that, you know, going back to kind of this theme, being neurodivergent, having ADHD, like having people to help run the day-to-day operations of our businesses is important, right? Yeah. The person who does that for me is Carolyn O'Brien. Shout out to Carolyn. It's really important to have someone who can make some of those decisions and figure that stuff out quickly.
Absolutely is. And it's so funny because in my practice, I've always had like a go-to person. It's always been one of my therapists that has always been like my direct line or like my external executive function system. And I hadn't realized that Vivian was that person for me for so long. And yeah, she was like amazing at notes. She was so organized. She could plan her butt off. A girl has like exceptional executive function skills. And before I even realized that I had ADHD, like she was my person that I leaned on. And so I ended up promoting her to clinical director in 2022, I think beginning of 2021. When she ended up transitioning out of the company in 2023, it was like, whoa, it was such a eye-opening moment for me to realize like how much I really needed that external support, right? That was a major eye opener to me. I think in private practice in general, you have to have a strong team around you. Like you just have to, because you wear so many hats, like you were saying, that there's always so much to do. You always have to like try to show up as your best in like every capacity. So you have to have a strong team around you that's going to help support your goals and your vision, right? Because you are the visionary when you're the leader. And so she really was that person for me. So when you have ADHD, it's like even more important, right? Because so many of us struggle with like executive function skills, just getting through our day to day. So it's really important, particularly for someone who has ADHD, to have that sidekick.
Totally. I mean, one of the things that is important is to just think, what are you dropping the ball on, right? To really kind of identify those things. Because there's a major transition for a lot of private practitioners when they go from solo providers, right? Solo therapists to hiring. And who you decide to hire first could go in a couple different directions, right? You could go clinical. And like, if you have a wait list, if you are like bursting the seams, you're leaving money on the table when it comes to seeing clients, then going the clinical direction is 9 times out of 10 the right decision.
Right.
For people who are having a hard time with like, the day-to-day operations of the business, sometimes it's actually a better idea to hire even a virtual assistant to help you get organized and to help make sure that any of the balls that you're dropping are getting picked up, right? And that you have systems and follow-up and all that kind of other stuff, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Those systems can be particularly tough for neurodivergent people to create and then maintain and actually follow. You could create it and then not follow it.
I do that all the time.
So yeah, definitely. That's such great advice for someone who might be having a difficult time or for whatever reason, is maybe the virtual assistant is your first hire, right? That way they can help you get those systems in place. And when I'm doing coaching calls, I'm always talking to therapists about your systems, people, your system, before you even think about hiring somebody, make sure you have solid system. But yeah, if you're someone who has difficulty creating systems, like getting them on the paper, then yeah, maybe a VA would be like the perfect first hire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and even like billing, right? That's one of the things I see some people struggling with for a couple of reasons, is like just remembering to bill.
Yeah.
Because it seemed like it's kind of boring, right? Like therapy is more fun and like
that's what you got into the...
And billing and documentation are boring. So sometimes you put it off, but that's how you get paid. Yeah. So you really put that off, right? The other thing I notice people putting off with that is because of like money guilt, right? Sometimes people feel, especially if you're doing private pay, people feel guilty charging people. So then they don't send them the invoice right away. And then they still feel a little bit bad. So they don't. And then meanwhile, this person is racked up quite a bill.
Wow.
And it gets worse, right? If you're just going to send them a bill for $200, no big deal. But if you're now going to send them for like $2,000 because you never sent them, that's really hard, right? So having someone who can basically do that for you and take it off your plate, sometimes people who are much better organized, who love to-do lists, love to show you, they love that stuff, right?
And you and I can't. People are like, who loves doing that?
No idea. But I think there's some people watching. I bet you there's some people watching who really are like, I'm organized. I like the to-do list. I like the satisfaction, right? Those people are not Alex and I, right? But that's why there's a place in business for all of us, right? That's really important. Alex, one of the questions that I've seen a couple times come through is, when did you get a diagnosis of ADHD? What led you to seek that out?
Yeah, I'm almost a year. I'm almost at my 1 year anniversary. So I was 37 when I got my ADHD identification. Diagnosis, identification, to me, they're kind of interchangeable, but I always just use identification. Yeah. And I sought it out because, okay, Jenna, I took my daughter who was struggling in math to go see a neuropsych. And I was like, this kid's brilliant, but why are they failing math consistently every year? But let's go to the neuropsych. Let's see if something's going on. So neuropsych ends up diagnosing my daughter, identifying my daughter as having ADHD. And so when you're in that process of being evaluated by a neuropsych, if you've got a good one, they're going to do some pretty intensive like case history. So she's sitting down with me on this couch in her office and she's just talking to me and I'm giving all this like background information about myself and my daughter and our family. I'm just blah, 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 blah. And she looks at me, Jenna, and she says, "You're next." And I was like, what do you mean I'm next? Like, what? She's like, "I highly suspect that you are ADHD. And I was
like, called out.
Like, it was so funny. "You're next." And so maybe a year went by and she did my assessments and 100%. Yep.
I love it. Hi there, Jenna Castor-Casbon here, and I hope that you're loving the episode so far. Chances are you've been listening to this podcast for a while and soaking up a ton of information from myself and our guests, and it's time to make the shift from dreaming to doing and go from inspiration to implementation. Successful private practices don't build themselves. At The Independent Clinician, we help regular SLPs and OTs become successful private practitioners using our proven systems. No more guessing, no more Googling, no more sleepless nights stressing about legalities. We can help you just like we've helped the guests featured on this show. They didn't guess or stress their way through private practice. Instead, they got step-by-step help along the way, and we're excited to help you too. If you need help to get set up and started with private clients on the side, the Start Your Private Practice program is perfect for you. If you've already started and you want to transition into full-time private practice and be successful once you're there, the Grow Your Private Practice program is your next step. To learn more about our programs, go to independentclinician.com. Now back to the episode. Did you think that things would have been different if you had been diagnosed earlier?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Oh, well, I think in just the way that my teachers spoke about me, or even the way that like my family members would speak about me. And this is not singular to me. I've met a lot of women who have ADHD who have heard very similar things to what I'm about to share. A lot of times women with ADHD, they're told that they're like too much in their head or they daydream too much. Put your feet on the ground. Be here right now. Or they're told that they're lazy or that they're disorganized. Why are you so disorganized? Why do you always start stuff and you don't finish it? Or this one, you have so much potential. You have so much. Why don't you do better? You have so much potential. And so all of that are like the words and the sentiments and the beliefs that I grew up hearing and believing about myself, that I was lazy, that I was disorganized, that I wasn't going to make it, that I wasn't capable. And a lot of that stemmed from my undiagnosed like ADHD. I was very ADHD as a child, very ADHD. And it baffles me that nobody ever sat down and went, there's something different about Alex. Like, maybe we should have her tested. So yeah, growing up, there was a lot of negativity. And so I've had to really work hard to push through that as an adult.
Yeah. And did that mean that you also had to kind of mask things a little bit and try? Yeah. Did you try to cover it up? Or even though if you didn't know that what the problem was, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So people pleasing, perfectionism, it's all really high in women who have ADHD, who went unidentified for a long time or who didn't get proper support. And so that people pleasing was definitely part of my personality, particularly as it related to my family members. And then masking, wanting to be the perfect student, right? But then feeling incompetent or feeling like a failure. So then just giving up and saying, you know what, it's not worth it because it's too challenging. So yeah, there was a lot of masking. I would say more in my young adulthood than as a student, because as a student, I was like, whatever. This is just too hard. I can't do this. But yeah, like in graduate school and then like in work settings, definitely a lot of masking to try to be the type A SLP. I'm like type Z. And I'm okay with that now. I'm proud of B. I'm never going to be type A, and that's all right.
And you and I have talked about this, but we both feel that having ADHD is a superpower.
Yeah.
For us. I felt some shame. So I was diagnosed more as a child, but I never did anything about it. My parents never did anything about it. And I actually don't have the H part. I had the ADD, like the non-hyperactive type.
Yeah.
Independence type, I think is what it's called. But I didn't get any therapy for it. I didn't take any medication. I just made air quotes, careless errors all the time in math and that kind of stuff. And then when I college and grad school, like my grades were fine, B's and whatnot. And then in grad school, I then figured out the whole type A SLP thing. And I really embraced being a type B SLP. And then I was like kind of the only one in my class. And it felt so weird to be like this, not doing everything perfect, not spending hours delaminating things, right? Making these intricate therapy materials. I was just like, and I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but like, where's a workbook, right? Nowadays, I don't really workbook therapy. I didn't have the skills to make these crazy projects that my peers were making.
And that's all right. And that's all right. Yeah.
I didn't care.
And I was like, give me that sock puppet and that random block over there. That's the kind of therapist I am. But yeah, it's interesting. So your parents didn't do anything with your diagnosis. Do you wish that they had done something? And like, what would that have looked like for you?
Oh, no. I don't know if it would have been like some sort of therapy. I don't know whether it would have been medication. I mean, I was able to get by really okay, mostly without it. But I'd say though, as an adult, so I revisited, now that I'm a grown-ass woman, I can make my own decisions. I did decide to try a medication last year.
What?
And it has made an enormous difference in my life in a very positive way. So would that have made some positive changes for me as a child or in school? Maybe.
Right, maybe.
But I would say as an adult, especially like with COVID and with just some of this extra stress of life the last couple of years, I decided to try it. And it's worked pretty well for me. And I recommend that other people at least get diagnosed first, but try medication and see if it works for you.
Yeah, I agree with that. And honestly, I think there was another SLP recently who told me that she had spoken to a doctor and the doctor was like, there's no point of doing a neuropsych evaluation to diagnose you with ADHD if you're not interested in medication. And she's like, but I'm not interested in the medication. And so the two doctors told her, well, then don't even do it because it's so expensive. But for me, having that breadth of assessments done and then having the neuropsych sit down with me and be able to explain to me, Alex, this is how your brain is working. And this is why you might experience life in this way, or this is why you might feel this way sometimes. To have that in-depth guide into my own cognitive functioning was life-changing, Jenna. That was the icing on the cake, was somebody being able to sit down and say, this is why you're experiencing your life the way you're experiencing it. That was amazing to me.
I love that you had that validation, right? Yeah. And that insight. So my question to that is, what did you do with that information? What changes did you make to, I don't know, accommodate yourself or something? But like, what changes came from that information?
That's such a good question, because once you get an identification like that, you need to make some modifications to your life, because most often, a lot of us who are older, or I'd say older women, but later diagnosed women, a lot of us before we're diagnosed are just like hanging on by like our fingertips, right? By the skin of our teeth. And so when a diagnosis like that comes to us and our world can be opened up in that kind of way, it's like you've got to make some pretty big changes, or the diagnosis identification can empower you to make changes to your life and the way you're living your life, right? That we may not have been empowered to before. One big thing that I changed is I dropped my caseload. Up until that point, I had a caseload within my private practice. So at that point, I was running like a team of 8-9 people plus myself, and I had a caseload and a business to manage, and it was a lot. And the neuropsych, who I actually cite her as a friend now because she's evaluated all both of my kids and me, and she's a colleague and I work with her frequently. She was like, you need to change the way you're doing life because you're going to kill yourself with stress. And she said it so just matter-of-factly, and it was so in such a caring way because she's known me. She's known my practice. We've worked together before. She sees how I'm raising my kid. She sees how I'm running my practice, and she's, you're going to kill yourself. You need to stop this. And that really made me take pause, because I was the person who was barely hanging on to the ledge before my diagnosis. To have a professional and a highly esteemed colleague sit you down and say, you got to make some changes, that really empowered me to drop the caseload that I was carrying. And it took me a couple of months to transition everybody off, but within a month or two, I had maybe like two kids on my caseload. I also made changes to my life, my vitamin and mineral routine. I started considering ADHD medication, some stimulants and non-stimulants. I changed my exercise. I actually get off the couch now, which is great. But yeah, it changed my life a lot. And I think around that time, my team started to see, hopefully, that I wasn't as stressed out and I was more available to them. But it also opened up like a can of worms emotionally. And so that was really difficult as well. But the changes came.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like a big soul searching time too, right? To kind of think Absolutely. About like, wow, this is kind of what I've been dealing with my whole life. This is why. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, to this point of things being a superpower, right? What are some ways that your ADHD actually helps you as a business owner, as a mom, as a person?
Yeah, absolutely. So in business, I mean, ADHD folks, we're extremely creative people, right? Yeah. I'm sure you have the journal just full of ideas, right?
Yep.
And I guarantee you, and I know you know this too, but like at least five of those ideas are like multi-million dollar ideas. And you know it. You know it, because we are just that good at manifesting Like, we're problem solvers. We see challenges and we're like, there's a void there. Let's fix that void, right? Let's come up with the idea that could fill that. And we're really good at that. And we're so creative. The follow through, that's the hard part, right? Why we've got the journal of 5 million great ideas and it's hard to move on it. But in my business, I would say, and my team has said this and will reinforce this as well, but I'm creative. I have really great ideas to lead this company. And so in my business, I think having ADHD, my creativity is my strongest suit. And then like in my personal life, because both of my kids have ADHD, my ADHD is a superpower because it helps me relate to my children. So much of having kids with ADHD and supporting them and managing ADHD is doing the work yourself as a parent. It's really about how you parent rather than about how we control these children. It's about how we're parenting. Being able to have even a little bit of insight into how their brains are working and be like, oh, I can relate to that. I remember being a kid and kind of doing that same thing. It's really strengthened my relationship with my children in astonishingly beautiful ways.
I love that. So sort of related to that, in our profession, I feel like in the last couple of years, there's been a shift in terms of really embracing neurodivergent people,
yeah,
right? Thinkers. And they, like when I went to grad school, which was 20 years ago now, but people was all like trying to get people to use eye contact. We were trying to, yeah, to extinguish all of those behaviors, which, yeah, now we're actually, this part of this movement is toward embracing things, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so we're starting to embrace our clients. How do you feel like the tides have changed as far as embracing neurodivergent clinicians?
I don't think they are. No, I think unfortunately we're not seeing that same carryover. And I'm so grateful. Don't get me wrong. I'm really glad that we're in this space where we're saying, hey, neurodiversity affirming strategies are a thing and we need to make sure that we're implementing them and that not all brains are the same and all brains are good brains. I'm really happy that we're in that space for our clients and our students and our patients. It's wonderful. But we're not seeing that same carryover to clinicians who are in practice, unfortunately. If anybody follows me on Instagram, I've been documenting my own challenges with a school district that I'm contracting with and getting ADA accommodations for my ADHD. 3.5 weeks later, I finally got them, but that's 3 weeks that you're expecting me to do work and I can't because you're not accommodating this very real challenge that I have. I think we have so much more to do. And I think because we're relatively new in this space too, that a lot of neurodivergent therapists aren't yet empowered to make requests for accommodations and modifications in their work setting. And a lot of employers, they're not familiar maybe with a lot of different neurodivergent types, right? And so they don't know how to accommodate. It doesn't excuse them from following the law, right? But I think there's a lot of education that needs to happen for employers. And then for people who do identify as neurodivergent to say, hey, these are your rights and this is how you can go about ensuring that your rights are upheld and that you get what you need. But I'm hoping that's like the next wave of the shift that we're in. I hope that it is. I try to use my platform as much as possible and my Instagram to highlight different ways that being neurodivergent impacts my ability to work or like different rights that we have as neurodivergent people.
Well, I think too that with especially women being diagnosed later in life, yeah, right, that we may be still having a whole, you know, real generation of clinicians who haven't actually been diagnosed yet. So that's one part of it. The other thing to it, we know that women also like aren't that good at asking for help.
True.
So we're really good at just masking things and taking things on and self-blame or just thinking, I'm terrible and this is like fault. I'm the problem. It's me. And I used to teach in a graduate program and I just remember students who I really identified with as air quotes type B, right? They're another type B person, right? Because we weren't really talking about ADHD, right?
We weren't.
I think that grad programs too are actually doing a terrible job of supporting those students, right? So people are kind of coming out of grad school feeling completely beaten up, questioning whether, just like you were at the beginning, questioning whether you should still be in this profession.
That's right.
And so one of the good things, though, is I feel like people like us are finding homes in private practice.
Yes.
And they're finding a place for themselves where you get to make the rules, where you get to make the schedule, where you get to decide how many people are on your caseload, or you can't start your day effectively until 10 a.m. No problem. Don't book clients.
That's where I'm at right now, Jenna. I'm like, don't talk to me until 10 a.m.
That's right.
No meetings or anything.
See? And so the ability to essentially, like, when you're your own boss, you can also do things to accommodate your own schedule and your own life and make things easier for you. And a lot of times, as your practice grows, that does come with being able to hire people to help fill in those gaps.
Yeah.
Like, I meet with Carolyn every week, and one of the literal questions she asks me every single week is, what are you dropping the ball on?
I love that.
I told her to add that to our lineup of questions. And she asks me every week. I need someone, I need to kind of have that self-reflection and say, okay, this is what I'm dropping the ball on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, can you help me pick up the ball and get it done? You know what I mean? But all that is really important. So I think that back when I was first thinking about private practice, like a million years ago, when I was well, it was, I don't know, 20, it was a long time ago, but I didn't think that type B people could, which is of course now like an umbrella for all these other things we're talking about, but could be in private practice, right? I didn't think that we could be successful in this, right? And what I'm finding is that I do polls every now and then in my programs. This may not surprise many people, but the majority of people who are commenting on the polls, again, who are in my paid programs, identify as type B or neurodivergent.
I'm not surprised.
The majority. No, it's not a giant majority. It might be like 57% or something, but there is a home for you in private practice.
Absolutely.
You just need, you need some structure. You need some systems. You may need some people to support you. But you can be successful in private practice, and don't let anyone think that you can't.
100. I'm so glad you said that. And like, I just want to applaud you right now, because that's such a powerful message that anyone who's listening right now needs to take away. And I've said this before too, that not only is like private practice really good for neurodivergent people, but it's almost like a must, right? It's almost like it's a must, because there are so few supports for us in typical work settings, in neurotypical work settings, that it's almost like we have to create our own journey, our own businesses, in order to really thrive, especially in a field like SLP that can be so rigid and so type A. That entrepreneurship really is like almost a must. And there's a reason why so many entrepreneurs identify as ADHD too. And there's something like, if you have ADHD, correct me if you know this one, but there's something like, if you have ADHD, you're like almost 200 or 300% more likely to be an entrepreneur than someone who doesn't.
I believe it.
Doesn't that just feel right? Like, it feels right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it is because we're creative. It is because sometimes impulsivity is bad, but sometimes impulsivity is actually good.
Yes.
And so, and not having that, believe me, I'm not making crazy risks, but I'm not afraid to take some risks sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And say, you know what? I can figure this out. Like we can problem solve this. We can try this and see if it works. We can make changes if it doesn't. And I think some other people are like, wouldn't even think about doing something if they didn't know for sure it wasn't going to work, right? I've tried things that haven't worked, and I've tried things that have been wildly successful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
absolutely.
So those are some of the superpowers that I feel like I have, and so many other ADHD private practitioners have, that I just want to encourage people to try this, either because you have ADHD or like in spite of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But give it a try.
Absolutely. And I love that term, like you throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely us. I've got 3 business ventures that I'm working on right now. And I 100% agree with you. I'm not afraid to take the risk. And do you know why I think we're like this? Because our brain is fueled by the doing, not by the thing being done. It's not checking off the box. Oh, I did a good thing. It's the actual doing. That's where we get our dopamine from. So it's almost like we're wired to try so many different things because it's so stimulating to our brains.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but sometimes I'll be like in the middle of one project that I'm so excited about. And then another project comes along and now I'm on to the next project. So much so that I have to like force myself to finish it. For example, y'all, so my book came out last March, right? And it took about 9 months to write the book. I was doing such a great job for the first about 5-6 months of it.
I hear that.
And then during that time, I came up with a new idea for a new program and I got really invested and excited about that. And it was everything I could do to finish like the boring part of writing a book, which is things like editing, right? All that boring stuff. But like you have to do that part before you finish your book.
Have a book.
But that was challenging. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's another thing is just, yes, it's very cool and fun to have like all of these ideas. But if you are going to have a business, you do actually need to complete some things, right?
You got to finish off.
Either you need to complete them or you need to have people on your team who can help you complete them.
There you go. Absolutely. Yeah, it's so true. I've started to really just like take my time with projects more now, like rather than being more impulsive and saying, okay, I'm going to start it and I have to finish it and get it done like immediately while the dopamine's still flowing. I've started to really just let them take a more natural course. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I'm finding a lot more happiness in that.
Yes. That's what matters, right? I think that when people are struggling with something that they know they have something going on and it feels bad, right? Feels kind of like a problem.
Yeah.
And you don't know what it is, right? It is so empowering to put a name to whatever that thing is. I love that your word identification. I think that's such a better word than diagnosis. Yeah. But anyway, as we start to wrap up, what advice would you give to fellow neurodivergent SLPs who are thinking about going the private practice route?
Yeah. And we kind of touched on this, but I think trying to understand or knowing your brain before you're getting started, know where your strengths are, right? If organization is not your strength, if planning is not your strength, and it's okay that it's not, make sure it's in your to-dos, in your plan, to find somebody that is going to help compensate for those areas of relative weakness for you. That way you set your team up right from the very beginning. You set your company up right from the very beginning. Also, like, community is so important. I could not do any of what I'm doing presently with Green Family Therapies or the SLP link. I couldn't do any of this if I didn't have a strong community. Yeah, that's really important. It's important to meet other people that know what you're going through. It's important to have mentors and guides and people that can think differently than you as well. All of that is incredibly important. So make sure you're connected into good communities. Make sure that you know what your strengths are and how you're going to compensate for your relative weaknesses. But yeah, those would be my top 2 pieces of advice.
I love that. Well, thank you for being on the show, Alex. Thank you for sharing your story, sharing your journey. Some real mic drop moments in there, but just also being the role model.
Badass.
I like that better.
I'll take that. I could both.
Perfect. Okay. Back to badass, being a role model. Being someone who's out there living their life very successfully and encouraging other people to do the same.
Thank you.
So where can people learn more about you?
Yeah. So my Instagram is ADHDSLPCEO. So you can find me there on Instagram. Also, you can follow the SLP link, which is my new venture. It's a web-based platform that offers communities, courses, and downloadable resources for SLPs by SLPs that will be coming soon, closer to the summer. So you can find me there on the SLP link as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for being on the show, Alex.
Thank you, Jenna. I appreciate you.
Okay, don't you just love Alex? I love how she learned to work with her neurodivergence and not against it. She is the perfect example of someone who figured out what wasn't working for her and took the initiative to do it her own way. The field of speech-language pathology and occupational therapy is evolving and making progress when it comes to neurodivergence, and Alex is part of that change. If you would like support to start or grow your private practice, please visit privatepracticeschool.com right now to learn about our programs and how we can support you. As always, thank you for listening, and please tune in next week for another episode of the Private Practice Success Stories podcast. Till then.
Well, this episode might be over, but we don't have to say goodbye. Head on over to independentclinician.com for resources that will help you at each stage of your private practice journey. If you're on Instagram, let's connect. Follow me and send me a DM. I'm at Independent Clinician. And if you're on Facebook, make sure that you join the SLP and OT Private Practice Beginners Facebook group. All right, off to help more regular SLPs and OTs become successful private practitioners. Let me know if I can help you too.